when you start out, I want you to post about anything you want. You don't need to post about email marketing. You don't need to post about marketing automation, CRM, like whatever you want to post about as a starting point. And then each week we reviewed two things: how many views and impressions were kind of coming in, and also how many inbound DMs or actual like messages of intent were coming in. And then we just compared it. We looked at like the people who are winning each week. What does their content look like? And then that became the guide of like, okay, this is what we see from the data. And so over time though, that will kind of show itself, but that way I can get people excited. They can post about whatever they're interested in. One of the biggest mistakes is walking in and telling a team, you need to go regurgitate our blog content. Like it just falls flat. It doesn't go anywhere, right? But if you let people in with that open structure and then just encourage everyone to follow the signals of where we see there's velocity, you can find out what actually works for your business, right? As you're kind of going along on that process.
Welcome to The Product Tea with Leah. I am your host, Leah Darin, and we are about to spill the tea with the best from tech about product growth and senior leadership topics. Welcome to The Product Tea, everyone. With a playbook that turns heads on LinkedIn and Quora, he does not just push the envelope, he practically invents new ones. Imagine booking your team on hundreds of podcasts as just another Tuesday. That's his world. At the helm of growth at ActiveCampaign, he's not just playing the game, he's on a mission to redefine it, aiming for the audacious goal of $1 billion in ARR. And with his track record, you'd better believe he's having a plan to get there. So if you ever wondered how to skyrocket your brand into the growth stratosphere or just want to have a peek into the mind of a growth genius, you're in for a treat today. Give it up for the one and the only Casey Hill. Hi, Casey. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. I'm doing better after that intro. Thank you. Excited to be here.
Oh, that's very good. How would you rate this intro from one to full traction growth channel, whatever?
I'm going to give it full traction growth channel. I don't know. I've never had that scale before, but yeah, I appreciate it.
I'm just going to pretend that I did not stumble over my own words here. So Casey, can you introduce yourself to the audience real quick in case there is someone here listening that does not know you, foolishly?
Yeah, I mean, I think you encapsulated some of the major things, but I've been in the SaaS space for over a decade, specifically focused kind of in the MarTech world for the vast majority of that. I've dabbled in, you know, launching my own products. I launched Kickstarter in 2018. I've done a lot of teaching. I'm teaching a course with Stanford Extension starting in April 1st around demand generation. So super interested in everything go to market. I've kind of been in sales and marketing leadership roles for a lot of that. Kind of got into institutional consulting the last 3 to 4 years. So working with pre-seed and early series companies, specifically around growth and pricing and churn and all that kind of fun stuff. So that's a little bit of my background.
Yeah, that's really cool. And we're going to take it there. But before we dive into the main topic, what do people get wrong about you once they get to know you?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think that I tend to be pretty obsessive, work focused. I'm the type of person slacking at 10:30 p.m. because I saw an interesting article or something that kind of caught my attention. So I think that sometimes people assume that I kind of like don't take any breaks and I'm just kind of constantly on. But I do. I do enjoy reading. I do enjoy getting outside and getting into the wild a little bit. But I think also I just genuinely love SaaS and the ability to build products that are transformative and change the world. I think I'm kind of like maybe one of those rare breeds. I'm not looking for just finding the side gig or finding the passive income stream or finding that kind of like perfect work-life balance. I am very interested in trying to do things that I feel like are going to be transformative in the years ahead. And that's just always something that has excited me and something that kind of drives my energy streams. So I'd say that.
Yeah, I think this is why we're probably going to get along, because probably my entire team just went like, oh, yeah, okay. He's like, Leah, that's good. She's also messaging me at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock in the evening like, oh, look at this cool shit over there. So this is what's happening from my side as well. All right, let's jump into the main topic. So one of the reasons why we got in contact is that, first of all, I think that you are really underappreciated on LinkedIn about the stuff that you post. And I'm not just saying that, right? So I think it goes quite a long way to say this about you, that you have very actionable stuff in topics that are quite difficult right now. And that is demand generation in channels that are just completely flooded by new technology, new processes, new market environments. And so we have AI, we have the interest rates going completely haywire, we have layoffs everywhere. Everybody tells you that sales is dead. Everybody tells you that outbound is dead. I'm very sorry for this, Casey, but like, why do you still have a job? I thought emails and like everything is dead. Like, what is happening there? I think, would you subscribe to that statement that it's completely dead?
It's funny. Email, I think, has evolved and changed so dramatically over the last 10 years. So when we think about what makes email successful, the first thing I'll say is I think that 90%+ of people who use email don't use it effectively. Right. So I won't say email is dead, but I will say the vast majority of people aren't using it as effectively as they could. And I think part of that starts with like a lack of a targeted goal. So one of the first things when I'm sitting down, I'm working with teams around email is like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to drive pipeline, or are you trying to drive conversions, or are you trying to create more product adoption, retention? Like all these different goals require very different structures of what you need to put together. So the first thing is what I can almost guarantee you won't work is the kind of amalgamation of everything, which is your newsletter is just like trying to do 20 different things and it has 10 CTAs and you're going in all sorts of different directions. I think that the larger you get as an organization, the more that you can do bottom of funnel content. When I came into ActiveCampaign, which is about 1,000 employees, one of the things that amazed me was how much revenue we drove from bottom of funnel, just like linking out to third-party articles, linking out to reviews, like direct kind of push style stuff, which I hadn't seen used nearly as much as ActiveCampaign. And ActiveCampaign was driving millions of dollars a year with it. So that was actually an education process for me of like, wow, I'm seeing the capacity of that in motion. But that's also because ActiveCampaign has a very large audience and very large pipeline to deal with. For companies that are on that kind of growth trajectory where they're kind of ramping into that, I think it can make a ton of sense to go more the direction of like a scaling SaaS. That this is a newsletter from Saster where they highlight, it's more top of funnel content, and they're highlighting those very specific growth inflection points for like these top companies. And it draws a lot of attention to their thought leadership. So I guess at a high level, that's the first pillar I would have folks focus on, is to be very intentional about the goal.
Good. So on the broader topic, what we're really talking about here, like if we take a step back, like what email is about, it's one of the alternatives that we have to drive some kind of demand in B2B. And how we drive this demand has been changing in the last years quite dramatically from the technology side and also like what kind of channels we have available. How do you think about this? Like when you are either when you are approached or like when you are like, what is the structure that you're going through? If someone says like, Casey, we have some money, we need to drive some demand and it needs to materialize in the next 1 to 2 years. How should we approach this? When should we go for email? When should we go against it? How do we balance this against LinkedIn, content creation, any kind of organic demand generation? How do we balance this? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a broad question. So we'll talk about a handful of different kind of components to it. So I think that if you're a company that already has a large existing audience and already has a lot of pipeline, I think email is a tactic that you can deploy fairly quickly. And if done right, like say linking people to high authority, third-party articles, bringing in outside trust, bringing in the right type of content that can kind of drive conversions, I think that can be a low-hanging fruit to close revenue this quarter. So I think email, on that sense, bottom of funnel focus, if you have a strong existing amount of pipeline. If you are a smaller company, if you're a startup, if you haven't cultivated that community, that audience, that pipeline previously, then I think with email specifically, it can be a good channel to build an audience. But just like all the things we're going to talk with, it's very competitive. So I think that if you want to stand out, you have to be willing to share a lot of firsthand data, to get into the weeds, to provide depth. I point people towards newsletters like Growth Unhinged, Mostly Metrics, Scaling SaaS. These are all B2B newsletters that I feel like do a good job of providing a lot of depth, a lot of specifics, and a lot of context. And I think all three of those serve as top of funnel newsletters, meaning that they're generating that demand, they're bringing in eyes off the top. And I think that can be the type of thing that it will take longer. You're going to need to look at subscriber growth and you're going to need to look at that over time, over often multiple quarters as you build that asset up. I think it's a mistake to get promotional too early with an asset like that. But if you have a longer time horizon, I think that can make a lot of sense. The other component of this, though, is I think that what matters the most is to make really good content and then figure out strategically how you're going to use it in different ways. So with that same kind of concept of very data-rich, sharing firsthand experience, if you go through the time to compose that article, you can then post it onto your LinkedIn. You can take it and put that into a newsletter clipping. You can go to specific subreddits, like I all the time go to /SaaS, /entrepreneurship, /B2B marketing, /email marketing. There's a dozen that I go to for my brand, and I think it'll be different for each company. But finding those different communities and then using that high quality content in those spaces. And I think if that content is top of funnel, i.e. not promotional, system agnostic information, that will be a way where you can often get a little bit of the best of all worlds, where you can take content, use it across many forums, and drive impact.
Let's double click on this a little bit and let's be very concrete about this, because you said a couple of really smart things in my mind that we have to specify a little bit. So first of all, when we talk about good content, I'm just going to tell you what I think about good content and then you just like mirror back whether you would agree with this. So what is good content to a very specific audience? Let's say we have an ICP in the banking sector and we know who that exactly is that we want to talk to. Or like, so we are the bank and we have an ICP where we know like, hey, you know, we want to sell to a very, very specific audience. The more narrow that we define this audience or like this ICP, the more clever we can actually generate content that is valuable for those, but that is not necessarily talking about our core offering. And I think this is one of the first things that I also have to onboard clients to, that they kind of understand, hey, it's not about advertising your stuff. It's not about always generating value in the sense of like, hey, if you use our stuff, then you're going to save this much and that much money. This is not promotional content. What we are talking about and what you're talking about here is that we try to produce good content in a very specific cadence to onboard a portion of a very specific ICP group that is talking to each other so they can start to depend on you, right? So like, hey, oh, okay, like in 2 weeks, another good article is coming that is relevant for me. And it's not so much about the selling part from your services. That actually is probably the minority of this entire thing. And this is what we're talking about when we talk about good content. And would you mirror this? Would you say like, yeah, that's on point?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think, again, I like to use the example of scaling SaaS from Saster because it's one that I think fits that mold quite well, that they're constantly associating Saster, which is an event company, right, with this idea of fast-growing SaaS. So that topical relevance is there. It ties directly back, and they're continuing to put that out. The fastest-growing SaaS, here's all the tips, here's what underpins it, and they're putting their name in association with that. So I think that is kind of the recipe. The other thing I'll note specifically on email that I think is super important, though, is expectation to reality is so, so critical. So one of the reasons that a lot of the newsletters I just named do so well is they follow a very specific format. So like with Scaling SaaS, it's like, here's 5 tips on how, or 5 reasons that this company scales, right? This top company scales. And they have it the same time they send each week. There's predictability in when you're going to get the message and exactly what's it about. And I think that is the formula for success on the engagement side, which obviously is ultimately correlated with the success of the channel.
So I want to talk about this really quickly, but before we go into this, you also said another thing, which is like the repurposing of content, right? So like we produce one content piece, for instance, like an episode, like this podcast episode, and then we do something with it, right? And we also post it in different channels. And I think it's quite important to see that this is not just like enhancing the existing or like the main piece that you're producing, as in much, it's already part of the entire complete plan. And I want to now tie a knot around this to your other point. What you basically said is like this expectation to reality, like this staying on top of mind, constantly being somewhere, or like invoking this Pavlov reaction, you know, like the dog that is waiting for the bell to ring and then the food is coming. So they're starting to produce saliva and all of this. This is what this is about. And I think we've talked about this in the pre-talk really, really quickly. We have to look at this kind of demand gen in a little bit of a different way. So like if I have $10 million to spend and I think I have to spend it in this kind of organic demand generation, I want to really spend it not in a way where I spent the most of it at the start. So, you know, like, hey, we're going to create some like crazy stuff just to go out of the gate, and then we're going to taper it off, and then we see whether it's going to gain traction. It's really important to have a long-term plan that has little investments all over until the end with an increasing efficiency in the traction that you're getting. I hope I explained this clearly over the air right now, but what I'm saying is that with time, your channels are also starting to become much more effective because word of mouth is going to create more dollars per word that you are starting to put out. Would you agree with this statement?
Yeah, I think you need a combination of short-term wins and long-term wins, right? And I think that, you know, one of the things that happens is if you have a heavy ad-based strategy, you're going PPC, SEM, the challenge is when you turn that off, you tend to go back to ground zero. So it can work very effectively at driving specific pipeline trials paid in a short term. But when you turn it off, you're back to ground zero. Whereas building owned assets from a community to a podcast to a newsletter has the ability to have that long tail impact. So I think that really what the best teams are doing is they're finding a combination of what needs to be done right now to drive velocity. You can't just get rid of that. If you only focus on long-term levers, it's going to be problematic. But I think the best teams are finding that right synergy between the short-term wins and the long-term wins. And I do think it depends. It depends how much cash you have in the bank. It depends on your burn rate. It depends on how much pipeline you've already developed. All of those factors are individual to businesses and might shift the percentage of effort and investment that gets put into short-term versus the slightly longer-term initiatives that you might be pushing.
No. So I think it's quite interesting because I have different scales of companies that are starting to implement their first growth team. And let's just assume when we talk about growth, we talk about this side of demand generation where like this is the first time where a company kind of dips their toes into the water, where they kind of try to get like this kind of experience in, right? Like they're listening to this podcast. They're like, hey, we have an entire growth team and now we need to decide what they're going to do in the sense. And now we want to approach this. So let's say we have exactly what you said, right? So like we want to have some kind of a picture of like short-term versus long-term goals. How do you think about the different channels and what would you say is more of a long-term channel and why? And what is more of short-term for, let's say, like a normal scale-up, 100 people, not a huge brand. We're not talking about Nike or Adidas or anything like this. We're talking really about the normal tech startup that probably not a lot of people have heard about. So we're really starting to think about brand building. We have the time. We have to burn. All of this is kind of fine. How should we structure this now from the ground up?
Yeah. So I think that in terms of short-term plays, there's a few. So I obviously talked about ads. That's kind of an obvious one. I don't think we really need to go deep there. Other things are things like partners and influencers. You can often pay an influencer around specific initiatives, around specific asset creation, and you can see whether that's going to work relatively quickly. I always encourage folks to work on longer-term structures, whether that's quarterly or annual with influencers. But that being said, I rarely see situations where within the first quarter of working with an influencer, you haven't seen the signal of whether that's going to work or not going to work. So I think you have ads, you have influencers, you have even things like podcast guesting, actually, interestingly enough. If you guest on 100 podcasts, it takes some time for those episodes to release. But within the time window when the majority of those release, you should be able to see direct impacts. At my past startup I worked at before I came to ActiveCampaign, our third highest attributed source consistently every single month was from podcasts, direct attribution on intake. We asked people how they heard about us. And that was steady. And that came from a concerted drive to push podcasts. And that showed up pretty quickly once we reached that saturation point. So I think those are like a couple of examples of things that can move quite quickly and that you can kind of orchestrate or organize around. In terms of longer tail, I think the three that kind of hop to mind are the ones I think I mentioned earlier, which is like building a community takes time. Mm-hmm. You have to look at the right leading indicators, but creating that network effect, creating the kind of the stickiness within it takes a long time. Building up your own podcast. So in contrast to guesting on podcasts, when you're building your owned asset, that absolutely takes time. And the best ones typically are like, it's a year plus when they're really starting to get a lot of momentum, especially if they don't have a lot of other shows they've launched before that kind of are providing that existing base to feed into. So I would say that one. And then newsletters. Newsletters tend to, especially if they're top of funnel focused, also tend to be a lever that takes time to build up over time. So those are three short-term and three longer-term levers on kind of the growth side.
How do you think about combining these two? So like we were also talking about this really briefly. So let's say, okay, we have community, we have building your own podcast, we have newsletter. These are all long-term projects. So they also have a slower ramp because there's a lot of competition out there. And, you know, building an audience is probably, you know, it's a slower ramp, of course. So we cannot just like increase spend and then we have more people. But how do you think about shortening kind of like this first period of also like, I don't know, for community, it starts to be a little bit difficult though, but like I think for newsletters and building your own podcast, how should companies think about just like shortening the first kind of 100 subscribers, so to speak? Is there value in like increasing also your paid spend just like to get over this initial hump? Or do you say like, hey, you know, like just test it for like 1 or 2 months and see for some signals before you start to invest a little bit harder? But how do we shorten like at least the first, like how do we optimize the first 6 to 12 months of anything?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would lean towards encouraging teams to invest in production value versus investing in paid spend directly to the asset at the beginning. That would be my preference. Meaning that if you're going to launch, let's say a podcast, I would rather have there be polish in the production value of that, in the landing page that people go to, like all of those components. I'd rather you spend your $5,000 MVP investment there then go spit out the episode, kind of bare bones, and run $5,000 worth of Facebook ads. I think that these spaces are highly competitive. So anything you can do that allows you to just stand out and get your foot in the door, once they listen to the content's either good or it's not good, right? And you create your stickiness and your word of mouth through that. But what you're kind of talking about in that very beginning inflection phase is, how do I get people to even pay attention to this? And if you launch a new newsletter or a new asset and you have like a solid production value trailer promo leading into that, I find that you're going to have more success than if you just took that and you put it into a basic PPC budget. So that would be my first kind of advice if you're going to spend. I definitely am of the kind of mindset that you don't want to overcommit and say like, I'm going to do 25 episodes of this thing regardless, doesn't matter how it performs, and just like commit all of that upfront. I support this idea that you set leading metrics. Oftentimes, those can be nonlinear for the best performing assets, but you can kind of do your homework and figure out what makes sense for your business and your model. But it's what at month 1, month 3, month 6 do I need to hit as a leading indicator that's showing this is going to have the momentum ultimately to be something that I double down and invest in and move to that kind of scale phase. And so I mentioned before the show, I was talking with Kieran, CMO over at Zapier, and he was talking about marketing against the grain. And they had set a benchmark of 50,000 downloads in 6 months. And he kind of talks about the benchmarks they put at month 1, at month 3, at month 6. And then he talks about once they hit that goal, then shifting over into a phase where they were doubling down, putting more investment, putting more distribution, like spending more dollars once that MVP had been a success for them. Now, obviously, that benchmark number is very, very high and is, I think, partially due to the fact there's a very large existing network there. But talk to people, get specific reference numbers. Don't go in blind. When you're planning on doing a channel, say, who is a company that's just one step ahead? If you're at 10 million, talk to the 20 million company. If you're at 20 million, talk to the $50 million company and learn about what those companies have done. I think people will be surprised how open folks are to share that kind of data with you. And use that as benchmarks to have the right leading indicators with those plays.
100%. I really, really love this because I was just about to ask you. So like, hey, if you have no clue, so how do you come up with your first targets? And this is exactly how you have to talk to people. Specifically, my issue is right now, performance from 2 years ago, like if you start from the ground new, is not the same as today. So you really have to talk about a company, how they are doing today. Because yeah, like everybody has a podcast. That's just like the reality. Everybody's on LinkedIn. Everybody has a newsletter. That's just what it is today. And I think I just wanted to add like two flavors to what you just said. I think on the podcast side, you're absolutely right when we talk about the quality. It is really mind-blowing to me that if you think about it, right? So like, let's say you record like a really good episode in your podcast. My very, very first one that I recorded was with John Cutler. He is still quite big exposed also on LinkedIn, right? Like a good quality guest. It still annoys me to this day that I was using a microphone that was just worth like $150 because there is no salvaging this. You can, through AI, you know, like you can polish some of the stuff and so forth. But like when we talk about podcasts, the audio quality is still what counts. It's not your intro. It's not all the other stuff. But what you do not record, you cannot add afterwards easily to this particular episode. And I would say to your point that there, I'm absolutely with you that the quality matters. On the newsletter, I do not agree that much. I think at the start, I usually try to really frame it in the sense of like, can you have a motion with a team that consistently puts out the same kind of quality that you have to find over a longer period of time? And then we start to look at the numbers. is probably more of an indication rather than just saying like, hey, just produce some content for kind of a month. Do you know what I mean? It's like the processes for written content, you know, like how long should it be? Do we have enough sources also for new insights and so forth? Tends to be harder on newsletters. And that's how I look at it. But other than that, like, I think I completely agree. Do not skimp on quality. You know?
Yeah. And I think to your point on that one, it kind of depends on who you are, right? Like if you're a person who already has a large footprint on channels like LinkedIn or other social channels, you introduce a new newsletter, people are probably going to know about, like they know about you, right? You carry that influence coming in so you can help accelerate that first period. But say you're a company that doesn't have that level of visibility. You're a smaller org, maybe you're 1 to 10 million ARR and like people just don't know about you yet. If you don't have some sort of concerted amplification plan for that when you launch, it's just like, I'm going to put it out there and let good content win. I think it's going to be a tough grind. If nothing else, it's going to take you substantially longer than if you had some sort of plan up front. And it might not be the same as like a podcast. It might not be the production value. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, you should go spend your $5,000 on making your newsletter pretty. But in that case, for a newsletter, maybe it's finding the right influencers who can talk about it, who can take excerpts out of it and say, hey, this new thing just launched. What I love is that they're doing XYZ. But you have some sort of concerted plan of what's going to make you stand out that gets beyond just the content. Because I think good content is what sustains and will help grow. But you want that catalyst in the beginning that brings people in and why should they pay attention to it? So I think it's always hard anytime we give generalized advice because so many brands are just in different situations depending on that starting point. But I definitely would encourage people, even if you have amazing content, to not just put it out in the world and hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think it's also a bit of a waste of effort as well. Like if you produce the huge guides just at the start without having any indication and any reach, like that's also a little bit, how we call it pearls before the pigs or something. At least in German. I think that's another problem that we have sometimes. I mean, save the big hits and like the big, big content pieces for when you have some kind of traction where you know whether it's going to hit or not. And yeah, but like maybe on this piece as well, like how do you think about gating your content in some ways? I don't know. We haven't talked about this at all. What is your opinion on this? Like, is you creating a guide, putting it out in the newsletter and then collecting another email for this, is that equal to the highly qualified MQLs that we're looking for?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in general, this idea that existed several years back of like lead magnets or people would put out like industry reports or best of whatever and got people to opt in, I think that's very, to a large degree, faded. I think that the expectation now for those types of things is that people can just access the content. And it's funny that the people who even lean the most into this, like the Shopify's who were like, that was like a cornerstone thing they did, You now see that they're like, yeah, you can opt in for it, but we'll also give it to you if you just like scroll around and try to find it. So I think that when it comes to lead magnets, most people are kind of ungating that content, if you will. That being said, I think the expectation for a newsletter opt-in specifically, if it's like join this new series, obviously like you're collecting emails in the beginning for that. I would say in general, because one of the biggest barriers around any new thing you launch is trust. In this market, there's so much content. There's so many people doing these things. Like the first thing you need to ask yourself is, why should I trust? Why should I trust this podcast, this newsletter, this asset, whatever? And that often helps if you can showcase how good that content is upfront. So I very much am of the volition of give as much as you can, show as much as you can, build that trust upfront to the very best of your ability. And then basically, if you bring people into like a newsletter, then I think that's fine to kind of build off of that. But I would encourage folks to gate as little as possible, I guess would be my candid answer to that.
I 100% agree. And I started to think about this in the concept of like building pressure in specific channels. And I think an interesting one on this is that, let's say you want to gather new followers for your newsletter or like your LinkedIn profile, whatever it is, right? So like we're trying to generate some kind of following. This is not about closing. This is like just like creating some kind of movement somewhere. There is absolutely no pressure from people who are new to you in some kind of way to subscribe to you, right? So like there's no pressure that we can kind of cash in because this is also kind of a currency that you have to cash in. So what I've been starting to say more and more and more for companies is that when you offer, for instance, a trial for a product or a freemium or whatever, it's totally fine to introduce some friction in regards to, hey, what is your email? Even on an interactive demo, let's just say like you have an interactive demo and like, hey, this is what KC offers as a business offering. It's totally fine to ask for an email because if someone is already willing to look at your interactive demo, what you offer as a company, right? Like we're now in the business offering, there is some kind of pressure that already exists that has been built up somewhere else. For instance, through a business case study or like through listening to podcast episodes and so forth. But because these two experiences are on different kind of spots of the, I don't want to call it the buyer journey because it's not the buyer journey. It's like the prospect's journey. I think this is how you have to look at it. So the later it comes, the more acceptable friction is. And it's also like, there's not a problem. No one will mind giving their email address if it's for a really good purpose, which is, you know, you're getting a freemium of our business product. Whereas on a business case study, there's just no buying intent behind this in the first place. And you can also start to create some really annoying, like negative word of mouth by just like trying to just at every corner, creating friction. And I highly discourage people also to do this, right? So like for every case study, just to collect every email and so forth. Try to think on it like, if we are building some kind of interest, where can we cash in on it? Then it's usually probably when they're looking at the interactive demos and so forth.
Yeah, 100%. It's a little bit of that like demand creation versus demand conversion conversation, right? Or demand creation, you're trying to seed this new thing. So like, for instance, let's say you have a partner manager, they've never dabbled in influencer marketing before, but you present some sort of detailed walkthrough with a brand who scaled up their partner motion with influencers, and they weren't even thinking of going influencers, but now they're kind of like, okay, that's actually pretty interesting. And you've kind of captured some interest. That's completely different from, I need a help desk tool. I'm searching around for it. So I'm then going to go watch the interactive demo and opt in for it, or I'm going to go, you know, actively try to seek out that thing. So I think that's well said. And this kind of goes into, as you build any kind of content strategy, where do you sit on that matrix? Like one of the ways I kind of often frame this for folks is I talk about, this example was originally used on social, but I think it can apply to a lot of things, where I say 5 degrees of content. And those 5 degrees kind of operate like this. So first degree of content, think of that as the most bottom of funnel. So in my case, if I was to post on LinkedIn and I post how active campaign compares to HubSpot, super, super bottom of the funnel style of content, right? That only speaks to a small portion of people with very high intent. Second degree content, a step above that, I'm talking about, say, marketing automation. I'm still pretty dang specific, but I've taken at least one extraction up and I'm a little bit more system agnostic with that. Third degree content, which is kind of the sweet spot, it's where I post the majority of my content, would be even one level up from that. I would talk about email. How do you monetize email? How do you drive results from it? How do you build organic growth engines? Email could be one of those, but that might even encompass a lot of different other areas. So third degree content is what I think of conventionally as thought leadership, is what people often call quality thought leadership. Fourth degree content, a level that even sits above that, is things that might be just generally business related. So if I'm talking about hiring, if I'm talking about pricing, I'm talking about these things, they don't really have any direct connection to active campaign, but they are applicable to a very wide array of people. So they can bring in a lot of eyes of people, if that content is quality, that are like, hey, Casey knows about these areas, and that can then generate a lot of followers. So again, as we're going kind of up the funnel, we're speaking to a larger group of people, but potentially with slightly less relevance, right? And then fifth degree content is what I call like the purely personal, like, hey, I just went on a vacation with my family and it was awesome. And I now feel like I'm a new person, right? That type of content, I think a lot of times people think is useless, but I actually disagree. I think some people have built strong personal connections in with the audience and they relate to a lot of people, and that can work for certain types of brands if it's consistent. But each of those degrees of content, I think, speak to a different application, like a different focus, a different goal layer, where one is building awareness, building connection to me. And then as you're continuing to kind of go down all the way to, I'm taking people that are already very interested and I'm trying to get that person to pull the trigger and go with my solution.
I think this is incredibly interesting because we're doing exactly the same thing when we talk about how do you onboard someone onto your product to actually buy, right? Like we also try to kind of separate this journey between, oh, I don't know you at all, between, hey, now you have to buy, which is the old sales-led way. We try to separate it into different steps, right? So like there's a freemium, which is your stage 5, whatever you want to call it, right? And then you have a trial, which is maybe stage 4 and so forth, right? So we start to kind of trigger this a little bit different. And here's an interesting question in this regard. Do you also try to separate the tracking of these different types of content? So let's say we have a newsletter and we're starting to also categorize like what kind of content we produce. You know, like, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do you also separate the reporting for this? Because if we just look at like at the general reporting, then we usually get the impression that this stage 5 content is performing the best because it always has the most kind of, it has no conversion power, but it reaches the most people. You know, like for instance, memes. I mean, Elena and me, we have built an entire career on just like shitting on sales-led companies on a Sunday. So I would love to hear your opinion on this because I really love this, right? Like in the end, it doesn't matter just about like the overall reporting, but it can lead you a little bit astray because you're just looking at this, like this wide content alone seems to be at least on the top of funnel metrics, extremely effective. How do you think about this? Do you also do split reporting? How do you evaluate the performance there?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of layers to this. So I'm going to start with what the initial engagement metrics are that are most valuable, and I'm going to kind of move through the rest of that question. So the first thing is opens are the least valuable metric for you to look at. With Apple Yep. Auto opens and all sorts of other things, like that is the least valuable. Then one step above that is clicks. Clicks is better. It's a higher intent signal, but even clicks sometimes are being auto-clicked and there's even manipulation there. So one mm-hmm. level above that is page views. Page views are now starting to get a little bit more intent. You're looking at, hey, someone actually went from my email and navigated to these different pages on my site. And then one step above that is replies. So the first thing is I would set a little bit of a test of what are the engagement metrics that are most valuable, moving from opens being least valuable to an actual reply from a human being the most valuable. But even if you're getting replies from humans, as per your example, if you build a newsletter all around, you know, your love of mountain biking, that's probably not going to drive a lot of SaaS intent, right? And so I think even if you're getting a lot of replies, that still doesn't work. So I think with those, you need to have a concerted strategy where you're looking at the actual things that matter at the end of the day. And it's just, it's about that process. So for example, if I'm posting on LinkedIn, ultimately, I'm trying to build a footprint. I'm trying to drive business for my brand. If I'm producing a higher percentage of, say, fourth and fifth degree content, and I'm seeing that that's increasing my follower count, I'm seeing it's increasing all of these kind of vanity metrics, but it's not increasing actual sales. It's not increasing attributed people that come in and they say, I heard about you from LinkedIn. If it's not increasing inbound DMs where people are asking to hop on a call or asking for more information, then ultimately that's not a good fit. Ultimately, those followers just aren't really relevant and that's not really the direction that you want to go. But it's something that you can validate. I've talked with many SaaS brands that have that combination and they're doing some of that fourth and fifth degree content as well as the conventional, you know, third degree and second degree content as well. And they actually talk, they've actually told me, no, I actually see the amount of inbound DMs going up and I actually see the attention going up because they have the right followers. They've cultivated the right network, right? So ultimately, some of this comes to the right network. If you gain massive visibility within a network and you've only added people who are, say, senior executives, founders, C-class, all of those right type of folks, and that type of content is giving you more visibility in front of those folks, then maybe that works for you. But I think you have to put it to the test of vanity metrics or even these leading metrics we're talking about. They need to all ultimately culminate in pipeline, in revenue, and you need to be running those tests as you go. So just one more note on this. Like when I started the LinkedIn motion, building that system for our team, one of the things I did is I said, when you start out, I want you to post about anything you want. You don't need to post about email marketing. You don't need to post about marketing automation, CRM, like whatever you want to post about as a starting point. And then each week we reviewed two things, how many views and impressions were kind of coming in and also how many inbound DMs or actual like messages of intent were coming in. And then we just compared it. We looked at like the people who are winning each week, what does their content look like? And then that became the guide of like, okay, this is what we see from the data. I'm not just coming in here and telling you, hey, you need to go rehash whatever content. Let's just actually look at the data. What does the data say? The data naturally, from my experience, is going to gravitate towards that third degree, system agnostic, heavily detailed, firsthand experience sharing style of content to drive the most meaningful business. That's what I typically see, right? And so over time, though, that will kind of show itself. But that way I can get people excited. They can post about whatever they're interested in. One of the biggest mistakes is walking in and telling a team, you need to go regurgitate our blog content. Like it just falls flat. It doesn't go anywhere, right? But if you let people in with that open structure and then just encourage everyone to follow the signals of where we see there's velocity, you can find out what actually works for your business, right? As you're kind of going along on that process.
I really like this for two reasons. And then I want to get really specific before we end this entire show. But so the interesting thing is like, if you apply everything that you just said, which I 100% agree with, and you apply this to a typical B2B business that has, I don't know, like a 20,000 ACV as their main client, there's some lead time in there, you know, like it takes months to activate and so forth. They usually have a problem that they do not have enough data unless they're already a huge company to test anything in their pipeline. Except what you just described usually is measurable to be statistically significant enough to figure out something, right? So like exactly as you said, you know, like, hey, we're posting like 5 content pieces every month or whatever it is. You start to have enough views and opens and clicks to have some kind of prediction. It doesn't need to be super accurate, but like this is now starting to be top of funnel predictable data that you can start to work with, even if the closing of this is going to come much, much, much later because your ACVs are so high. But I want to say one thing here, and this is quite interesting to me. So like, let's say you're starting to build a new motion out on this and it starts to gain traction, you know, like, hey, you know, like last month we had 5,000 opens. Now we have 100,000, right? Like we're starting to get into this kind of curve that is really crazy and we're starting to grow. If you have a PLG motion and you're in this mid-market segment, so you're a B2B company, you're selling to 10,000 to 20,000 KACVs. These leads still take 4 to 5 months to kind of activate and maybe show up also in your sales funnel. So sometimes this motion is already working, but you're not noticing it because they have not converted yet into people who pick up the phone and then call you. So it can take time, you know, like from your content, you know, like to build up, like to convert someone to actually go into your freemium. And then because you have a freemium, you're also kind of delaying like this activation process a little bit, which adds another 4 to 5 months to this. And this is why this is such a long-term play where you also have to a little bit of trust a bit. And specifically in B2B, I'm very, very skeptical if someone tells me that, oh, you know, like you can start a motion like this in like half a year and then you already generate leads like crazy. You should generate some leads, but you will definitely not know about it if you do not track your side of the story that you just mentioned and very, very closely on the freemium side, on the trial side, exactly what you said. Where did you hear about us? I'm a little bit skeptical how accurate attribution is, by the way, but at least it tells you that you came from one of those channels, at least in parts, right? So I find this entire kind of framework super, super cool. That's really good.
Yeah, I think also gathering information upfront can be really helpful as your first early signal. Like if you ask someone a very specific question around that new person, that higher ACV, that mid-market account that's coming through, if you're asking them a detailed question about a specific challenge that they have that's maybe topically related to where you're at, right? So like say someone's opting into my old newsletter, Growth Corner, I was asking them like, what is your major growth challenge? And I would actually recommend people ask a more specific question than what I asked back then. But if you ask that targeted question and you get meaningful replies, that's actually one of your first validation points that this is an actual person who would be a good fit. If someone just responded to that and said like leads, like one word, I'm like, okay, that might be like a little bit of a spammy person. If someone explained to me like, hey, this is where we're at. We've struggled because we're at a 5% month over month churn. We know that's not sustainable, but we're having XYZ problem. Okay, cool. Like that person, just by that one reply that they've done, has given a strong signal that they're probably a viable opportunity, even before we've gotten into the freemium motion and all the different like product adoption components. So I think you have to take the best info that you have at each stage, gather a little bit of information up front, use that as your first validation point. And then you're tracking those engagement patterns with that spectrum from opens to replies in terms of priority. And then as soon as they get into the product in any capacity, you're really trying to study like what are those patterns of successful activation. And over time, you should get much better at understanding those. And obviously with the advent of AI as well, AI is going to be a substantial catalyst in helping you look at hundreds of different variables and incorporate those all into a persona. So I think that that'll be another component, that the phase two of where this is going to go. But I think that you look at each stage of the journey as best you can. And the longer that you run those processes, the more you'll be able to see this is the exact version of our ideal customer. They come in, they answer a question, they get into the product by month 3. Even if that's 6 months, even if it's 12 months, you'll be able to start to track that journey and then know what are actual real pipeline opportunities versus kind of the more fluff vanity metrics.
Yeah, I think this is all very much on point. I'm just going to add one thing, or like one trick that I've seen work also like in the onboarding flow in this regard, like whether this is on the newsletter or whether it's also on your website, by asking on a dropdown, like from which industry they come. And I'm not talking about these dropdowns that have like 500 industries listed, just like the three of your ICPs that you think are relevant. This is very important data to connect because you might also start to notice that specific industries are starting to behave different in your product. You know, like, so for instance, construction workers are just using mobile phones all the time, which is very, very real and completely different to some other ICPs that you might have. And the interesting thing is by you asking this question, you also give a feedback back to the person who is now in your onboarding flow, whether they are actually the correct fit for your product. This can also sort pipeline. So we don't want to destroy leads, but sometimes this is also a problem that we just have, you know, like a fuzzy kind of targeting. We're attracting the wrong ICPs that we do not really want to talk about. And sometimes we can really filter them also by industry. So combining these two things together, that can actually work quite well in my experience.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I would add one layer of nuance there, which is because people often ask, if I'm just going to ask one question, what should I ask? Should it be role, company size, industry? And the answer to it, I think, is what messaging are you going to send that is most valuable to a customer? So if industry is the major thing, industry is the major decider of different types of content and onboarding, then you should 100% ask for industry. But if you find that it's actually company size, a 10,000 person e-commerce company is more similar to a 10,000 person B2B SaaS company than a 5-person e-commerce company, and you only want to ask that one question, then you should probably ask company size. If that's the meaningful thing that you're going to be able to send case studies and differentiation and like, hey, they're a larger company, so they're going to need to have roles and permissions and security features and, you know, XYZ integrations. So I think that is the first kind of layer of litmus test that you should have.
Yeah, and if you have a good one-pager, you can also frame it in a sentence. Like we had this from Paperspace in my cohort where Benjamin Lamson was presenting the way that they are starting to qualify their leads. It's like, I am a so-and-so from so-and-so interested in so-and-so. And there were just like a few drop-down messages that they could select. And it was super slick. It's just like you form a sentence about yourself. Boom, suddenly we have a lot of information about you that we can sort on different dimensions. So yeah, huge fan of this. Casey, thank you so much for this interview. This was extremely valuable. I could have stayed for another 2 hours, but I think I have to let you go at some point. Do you want to let the audience anything know? Like, how should they get in contact with you? Do you want them to get in contact with you? How can they reach you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am very active on LinkedIn. That's my major channel. So if you just go to Casey Hill, you can find me there. And if anyone has specific questions around marketing automation or their stack, you can always send me an email, chill, C-H-I-L-L. At activecampaign.com.
It will be in the show notes, and that's the end of this episode. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Cheers. Thank you.
Ba-boom. Thank you so much for listening to The Product Tea with Leah. If you don't have enough yet, you can subscribe to my podcast right now at Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or you can head to my website, leahtarin.com, which is leahtarin.com, where you can find much more of my material or just want to work with me.